Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
People who are here this way, and people who are here this way. It's a spring session. Winter wasn't very hard this year, so the relief isn't as great as it might normally be. But spring is spring, nonetheless. Grass grows green, and the buds on the trees start to bloom, and birds chirp like mad. Not particularly worried about the winter past. They're practicing spring. As I told Roshi, you know, when you're young, most people here are quite a bit younger than I am. Not to insult anybody's age. But there's always a sense that you can return to session. There'll be another session. Maybe in the summer or the fall, next year, years to come. But by the time you get to my age, you can't say that, you think that. This is what I like to tell the kids. You know, I could drop dead in the next 30 minutes or 30 seconds, and there might be people who are sad to see me passing and this, that, and the next thing, but there wouldn't be anybody who would be surprised. In deciding what to talk towards, one always, at least this one, always goes through a certain kind of thrashing about this, that, the next thing, God. Jumbo Roshi once gave a talk right after he had been recognized by Ito Roshi. He gave a talk on Mu, first calling in Hong Kong. And he got up on the stand and read the koan and looked at everybody down and left. And subsequently said, you always wanted to do something like that. So there's this thought that goes through my mind, well, push comes to shove, I just always stand up and leave. Everybody, what was that all about? But there has been a theme running through my mind for a while. And it sort of pivots off Philip Kappel Roshi's Three Pillars of Zen. Many people here have a copy of Three Pillars Zen in their position. Raise your hand. Okay. Have you read it? Yeah. Yeah. It was the first book on Zen that I read, and it had a big impact on me. So today, in that tradition, I'd like to talk about three things that, to myself at least, I have been calling the three pillars of ONG. And they are meditation, practice, and tradition. And so, with your patience, I'll say a few words on each of these topics. Zen, of course, is the Japanese word, Japanese translation of the Chinese word Chang, C-H-A-N. And that was their translation of the word samadhi from Sanskrit. So from India, China, Japan, and now to North America, the United States. We are involved in meditating. And most people become interested in Zen because somehow in their mind they associate with meditation. And in their personal life they have decided that they want to learn how to meditate. And so they put the two together and they look down at the museums and phone book. And if they're lucky, they will find something about Zen. Tell how old I am. And they'll punch it up and Zen station. Can I come down and learn how to meditate? When's a good time? Can I come down this afternoon? No. How about tonight? When can I come down? Well.
I'll go try to stop it.
Close the window.
I thought it was just
going to
drive by.
It's gone, but I... It's okay. You see, I stopped it. It's at least as interesting as I am. Anyway, I'm down on Thursday nights once we get rolling again. That's where we... sort of a beginner's night after fashion. People come down here and they... and looking around, this looks pretty formal. It's like, you know, we're just going to sit down in some chairs around the table, talk about mindfulness. And, not exactly. You're going to sit down here, you can use a cushion to sit on, and sit here, and you want to sit this way, with your butt on the ground, and your legs folded if you can manage it. But if you can't, you can sit seesaw. Or if you can't, you can sit in a chair. That's okay too. But you know, most young people, they come here down on the floor. And then you can count your breath. Let's have to do meditation. That's a good way to learn how to meditate. It's a little bit feel for it. Count your exhalations or inhalations, or count them both. If I got to count for the whole time, yeah, that's a big number. No, just count to 10. Start over again. 10. Start over again. There's something magic about 10? No, nothing magic about 10. If you want to, you can count to 7, or 3, or 13. 10 seems to, maybe because we've got 10 of these things, 10 seems to be a traditional number. So you might want to start with 10, and then if you feel very creative, you can branch off into some number at some point. Yeah. Let me sit down, and then all of a sudden, bang, goes the bell. Clapper. And then maybe we start with the chanting. Page 10, open your sutra book. What the? Eventually that stops. Something else. Anybody still sitting? And Thursday night sits tend to be somewhat compacted, 30 minutes or so, plus or minus. And so you do this two or three times, and eventually, and then walking around, walking, what's this business? You shove me to get up next to the person in front of me, and, you know. You should stand with it. So anyway, you go through this experience, and eventually it's over. You go home and you say, are they still doing transcendental meditation around here someplace? There's no bad. But for some reason, some karmic reason that's mysterious, you might stick around. Something in the air, in the root group, in the faces of people. Stick around. And slowly, everyone at their own pace, you learn to manage cushions. You learn that pain in your knees or in your back or wherever you feel it, as bad as it is, damnedest thing, you can just about get through a city without screaming. And that's kind of novel, to be able to tolerate pain. And some people, sometimes, experience a great deal of pain. It's not just, oh, I was a little bit sore, but they're right on the knife edge for the whole sip. And they learn to balance on that knife edge. And then somewhere along the line, Roshi or start hearing about colons. How is that?
Well, it's a public case out with the Tang Dynasty China.
Tang Dynasty China? Where was that? You know, Chinatown down on the one, down in the city? No, much further back. And eventually we develop some skill managing your cushions. Always interesting, you start session and there's one cushion in every place, except maybe the residents that were here on a regular basis, they may have two cushions, but generally just one cushion. And then there's a whole stack of cushions out here in the foyer. And then as the session slowly rolls along and rolls along, stack of cushions out in the foyer goes down. And cushions start appearing everywhere. And someone says Zazen is a process of cushion technology. And I've said that. It took me quite a few years to figure out how this body could sit without being too painful. This kind of cushion of this thickness tilted here and whatnot and so forth and so on. And over the years, I started out with a lot of cushions and then I went down as my body got more and more acclimated. And then started going back up and up, and now my cushion is in the form of a chair. Not because I can't sit on the floor, but it takes me half a sit to stand up. That's not helpful to people who are trying to be in motion. And as Roshi said in her opening remarks, as we become physically acclimated, or as acclimated as we're going to be. You start getting into these mind games with yourself. And in this tradition that is outside the scriptures, not dependent upon words and letters, and letters and words, we slowly start building up our Zen bookcase. And when we read over these, the instances, this, and we start pushing. We hear about enlightenment. You hear something like, you know, before I was enlightened, I was a son of a bitch. And after I was enlightened, I was an enlightened son of a bitch. And then you kind of wonder, well, what's that all about? But you develop agendas. I just do this, and maybe I make some real progress. Progress? Oh, yeah, you gotta make progress. Look at all these old times. You know, and I'm sitting here looking like this too, but inside it's Ed Oroshi used to like to say, he gave a talk, this business of Zazen came up. He would say, Zazen isn't hard at all, just sit. Just sit. And of course, the rub is in that word, just sit. I went into Dokusan with him one time, and I don't know what I've been doing, but anyway, I went in, and there's the man. He said, just sitting. And I felt like a pan of butter on a hot skillet. And then took his socket. He drew an imaginary line right in front of my knees. Then sit. As if this line is the edge of the universe. Mm-hmm. I hear the report when I went back to the Zendo, my just sitting. It changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And I can still see that line. I can see it today. Mm-hmm. The edge of the universe. And so Zen is about, as much as anything, is two aspects. One, coming to terms with your body. Ed Oroshi used to say that Zazen is a body practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, body practice. There was a wedding down at DVC long ago. And on the last day of session, and then they had the reception in the dining room down there. And it was well attended. There must have been around 200 people in the dining room. There's the Japanese locals going around with hot sake and, you know, topping off everybody's glass. And, rock and roll, you know, the Zeppelin and Cream and that sort of thing. A lot of people are interested in me enough. I don't even know who the Led Zeppelin is. And I was sitting on the table. We were sitting, and people were dancing. It was, you know, looked like a bacchanalia almost. And, you know, I was sitting over here. And I asked him, I said, Roshi, where is all this energy in the East, in Asia? And he says, Zazen takes tremendous energy. He grabbed me and threw me out on the floor. There was a solo dancer, you know, whatever. takes tremendous energy. And that makes sense once we realize that the body is connected to this spinal cord, to this thing, and vice versa, this thing is connected to this thing. And so what goes on in the body influences the mind, what goes on in the mind influences the body. So Zazen is learning that it's a mind-body process practice. And the body adapts about as much as the mind can get with it, and the mind adapts about as much as the body can get with it. And so, slowly you bring these two together. And one of the ways of thinking of Zazen is integration. Trying to overcome this split, which right at the bottom of the lungs, the diaphragm, it's the European psychological split right here. Interesting in psychotherapy, talk about all sorts of things, and inevitably, not all the time, but most of the time, when people are referring to anything having to do with genitals or anything, the word used is down there. So there's this split. Down there, and up here where I am, where everything is smooth and easy. And, I don't think there's hardly a talk I've given here that I haven't mentioned this word, sincerity. Mm-hmm. Overcoming splits. There's a long, cute historical story behind that. Not this time. But anyway, there's this split that most of us Europeans live with. And Zazen is overcoming that split, overcoming that insincerity. We're down there, not at all interested in what up here is thinking, and up here is, you know, down there. And slowly bringing these two together, not in a wrestling match, not in a duel to the death, but as right leg, left leg, upper teeth, lower teeth, right hand, left hand. And they're different, but they work together, they put together. And so Zazen is a process of integration. And the umbrella that covers this integration, but there's two umbrellas, maybe three or four or a dozen for that matter. One is I like to mention, and I think it's always important to keep track of, that this is a vowed practice, not just mindfulness. So, however, we're innumerable. However, we're exhausted. However, measurable. However, all. I vow. And so, while on the surface it may look like some sort of mind body exercise, at the deepest level, now, and it's always important to remember that. So that as you struggle with your Zazen, in whatever fashion, you're struggling for a good purpose. graceful purpose. If you will, a holy purpose. And so Buddhism, just maybe in the last 50 or 100 years, has been accepted as one of the world's religions. There was a time, 200 years ago or so, where Europeans considered Buddhism just a philosophy. But Zen is, in some sense, a religion. We'll say that as a baptized Roman Catholic. We don't know what that means much anymore either. But it's not just mindfulness. It's not just lowering your blood pressure. And it's not just me at this moment. It's all of us across the years, across the centuries, across the eons. So when I say, however innumerable beings are, I'm liable to save them all. I'm just the voice at this moment, at this spot, for all these. Maybe not have anything to do with them, anybody who feels this connection to humanity. This is a Buddhist story. We're flying along in an airplane, which isn't exactly Buddhist, but anyway, we're flying along. And we only have a window, and there's this horrible forest fire up here. Some terrible fires out west. Many people have died. Thousands of acres have been reduced to charcoal. Fire. Here's this bird. Bird flies over the fire and opens its beak and drops a waterfall out. Turns around. It must be stationary for this. At any rate, maybe it's a helicopter. And the bird goes back down to this creek, picks up another deep full of water, flies back, two more drops on this raging inferno. Hey, you're a pretty small bird. Way less than an ounce. You're only dropping two or three drops of water on that fire. What difference? I mean, that's useless. I just go home and watch the news or something. Yes, it's very little, this is what she said. I don't have a choice. There's so much suffering. And I don't know what my two or three drops do to help out, but cannot do otherwise. So when we sit, we sit together. Lots of times at home, we're sitting by ourselves, or what have you. We get this sense, maybe, that we're this bird. And you each vows, no vulnerable people are interesting beings, sentient beings, insentient beings, great beings, small beings, bodhisattvas, that is the greatest. It's one whole gobble of beings of all varieties. And I'm going to sit here and say it. If you just look at the words, that's pretty far out. You would say back in the 60s. Go for it. And so another aspect of meditation in the Zen Buddhist tradition is to realize how connected we are. Just as we're trying to connect this with this, connecting this with this, with this, with this. In this session, all of us together, attempting to connect with the walls, birds, trees. And that's just kind of the wonderful part. The war in the Ukraine, fighting in Sudan, the starving in Sub-Sahara. There hasn't been any water in a while. It's just an awful need. Yes, there's need for dollars and food, peacekeepers, and yes, and more of it, hopefully, and more effective, hopefully. Yet at the same time, has an impact. It can hardly, can't be described, can't be. It has an impact. What that impact is, whether it's now, 100 years, or 1,000 years from now, when we bought this property, this house, this was a stable, as you probably know, most of us do. And we sat over in what is the Dharma Hall now. To tell me that, so that there's about 10 of us or something like that. And the theme of that session, first one, was to leave a good impression for all those who are to follow. And so just in the living memory of this sangha, we are riding, sowing, gifting, on the effort of those 10 people. Meditation. You eventually learn to stop time to produce certain states of mind. Now, when I was young, of course, you know, LSD and psychedelic things were really interesting. Everybody, please move. Water rituals are really interesting. You should give everybody a cup of water And the person who's speaking has to, you know, if there's more cups raised, he can keep talking, but or stop talking or something like that. Word meditation means, so it's a word derived from Latin, med meaning middle, is a median. Then the tari, the back end of the word comes from the Latin word tari, which means move towards. That's interesting. Move towards the middle. Think about that. The middle. Not set up shop in the middle, but move towards it. Work at it. Move towards the middle. Middle of what? And how do you move? Everybody said you did still. There doesn't need to be much movement there. So, one pillar, the whole energy is Zazen. The next one that I thought of, you almost sequence these. People start out learning to meditate, whatever that means, and then they've got some strange things going on down here. But okay, so you learn to meditate. And soon enough, everybody on their own schedule, this practice starts to insinuate itself into your life. There's a saying, the Zendo runs out the door. Converse of that, of course, is, you know, the city runs into the Zendo. And that's true, too. The Zendo runs out the door. Of course, means that what's going on here has a way going with you in your everyday life, whatever it may be, professional life, service life, she cooked bottle washer, and so forth and so on. And so the next part, in terms of this little formula, is this word practice. Now, if you think of a lawyer or a doctor, those are the ones that the most obvious ones. Doctor's practice, of course, I mean, he's doing medicine. That's medicine. But when he's not doing that, he's checking with insurance companies. She's trying to set up retirement plans for the staff. He's got to negotiate next year's lease with the building owner. And the fire inspector came through and said that you're a hazard to the city, so you've got to take care of that. And so forth and so on. And you find that doing medicine involves all of these peripheral things which on the face of it have nothing to do with, you know, drawing blood. And it's called a practice because it involves so many things. And so Zazen, I'm going to throw this in, lest I forget it. After 40 or so plus years of doing this, people, you know, ask you, well, what's Zen? Or ask myself, what is Zen? I still do that periodically. And I came up with arguably, I think the best definition by Zen, it's very simple. And that is Zen is a way of life informed by the energies and insights of sitting in meditation. Way of life informed, supported, guided by the energies and insights of sitting meditation. And so as we sit, this strange fashion, the energies and insights start to flow through us, each in a different way. There's no standard way in the book. The flows. And we find that the little offbeat details of our life, we start looking at from a Zen perspective. Maybe you find that your house is a little bit neater, your apartment is a little neater, your room is a little neater, not because you're going on a neat campaign, it just seems to kind of happen automatically, so to speak. We find that the way you keep your desk, it's getting a little more organized, not because your significant other says, I don't see how you do it. That's why they turned the electricity off last month. You didn't pay the bill. Well, it was a standard remark when the kids were young. Yeah. Electricity would go off, and one of them would say to Santa, did Dad pay the bill? You find that you're way with people starts becoming more even paced, more patient, more loving, less critical. And even if you can't be less critical or more loving, even if those things are beyond your grasp, at least you know they're beyond your grasp. Aware of things that before you came through this door, you weren't so aware of. Or maybe you were, but now you're aware of a new fashion. And maybe you were very kind and loving to this group of people, but that group over there, you just seem to push them off the edge. And now, and so meditation starts informing what we do. We find ourselves moving. As if our life has purpose, direction. Last time I was giving a talk here, I talked about Joshua's oak tree. Mm-hmm. The cardinal principle of the garden. Yeah, the oak tree out in the garden. Well, we spent some time with that, and I concluded that he was completely wrong. It had nothing to do with the oak tree in the garden. It had to do with the silver spruce in my front yard. So I've named that spruce Joshua. Mm-hmm. Every night, I say good night to anyone that was Meeting here will have a substitute discussion. Well, anyway, someone wrote me a note and said that they appreciated my talk. I think they were watching on the tube. Pretty sure. But anyway, the person said that they were doing some chores in the backyard. And they noticed that this tree was bowing to them. And that's why they noticed that, because they were bowing to the tree. Things happen. This integration that starts here, starts to flow here, down here. And the Zendo runs out the door. So we have some residents here. We have a residence hall, and that's a building. And that's a more practice. At the end of the day, this is not a monastery. We're not up on some mountaintop and never getting into the city or maybe once or twice a year. This is an urban Zen center. Not even in a big urban, this is a small town, 130,000 people all around. And so as we come in from our lives, doing this, doing that, whatever, we come and sit. City comes with us. Our children come with us. Our loved ones come with us. Problems of the world come with us. So there's a two-way street. Which is Zendo, yours is back there, and back there, yours is in here. And feeling this and living this is what I call practice. This way in which our life becomes informed by the energies and insights of sitting meditation. And the third one, there's this I think, I don't know if it's Zen per se, but there's this Buddhist group in Kyoto that their practice is running. And they have these kind of devotional stops throughout the city, and they get out there and run. And it's about a 10 or 20 mile circuit. And you start out in the morning after breakfast, you're there, you run. They run, until they get to the next kind of devotional stop, and they say some prayers, do some chants, whatnot, bow, whatever, and they go running again. So you feel as if this is too stationary for you. You go to Kyoto and start running. and that's an interesting way. I raced bicycles for about 20 years, and rode until I had this pretty terrific accident here about 4 or 5 years ago. Came around the corner and I was looking this way because there was bushes here and I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to get run over. And by the time I was turning left, and by the time I focused left, I was about a foot from this parked car. We were about 20 miles an hour, so I went from about 20 miles an hour to zero in about 3 feet. And broke various southern bones, concussions, lung punctures, and and I got the bike fixed up, and but a couple months ago, I took everything that had anything to do with bicycling and donated it all to advanced cycling. I said, take this thing. You want to throw it away? Throw it away. I couldn't throw any of it away. And I said, all those tools, equipment. But anyway, I bring that up because when I was bicycling, pedaling became a mantra. Sometimes, and I would go out on a 2 or 3 bicycle ride. It was that or maybe the Heart Sutra, like reciting the Heart Sutra. And I knew certain distances or routes or how many times that my speed, I was never fast. Say, I was in that group that was fighting me down for dead last, next to last, almost last. Literally, so this particular route was 13 arm sutures synchronized in the pedal. And after a while, that was the only way I could bicycle, was to synchronize it with something out of this world. Walking, now I walk, and I walk, and I get into these things every time you come to a stop sign, change the foot, so it's still leading with the right foot, and I'm going to the left foot. And you get around that area. You're an obsessive engineer. But this zendo, this practice, is bad. Integration. Stands on the shoulders of a long line of people, just like you and me. Started out, just like you and me. Encountered the same problems, just like you. Same impediments. All the way around. Allowing for the 3 years of 2023 and taking 520 Bodhidharma, we're just 1,500 years into this. And everything we do, and the manner in which we do it is responding to these 1,500 years. Obviously, things are slightly different. Somebody from Tang Dynasty China, and you planted them on here, right there. Spring session in Hoa and Chi, they probably say, my God, what did they do with this practice that I love? I don't know about you folks, but I've got, I'm not counting the Zen books I've given away to people, I've got about, I think they're four shelves, bookended, four shelves of Zen books. And, you know, I've read just about all of them, or read him all of them. I'd say there were about three quarters that I've read cover to cover. There's a few I've read more than 10 times, which I remember. You find something that you've read that got some energy for you. Go back and read it every other year. Every 2 or 3 years. The one that stands out is Suzuki's Zen Doctrine of No Mind. First time I read that was in 1978. Yeah, I know that because I've got writing. And every time I go through it, it's 78, and next one has got a pencil, a blue ballpoint, a rare ballpoint, a sharp pencil, a wide pencil, a big pen, and whatnot. So as I go through and look at all of these annotations, I can tell when they were made. And it's really funny because you'll find, I think I read one in here one day. Passage in that book that really touched me, and every time I got to it, I would write some note on the side of the margin about how it impacted me. And I'd write down, write down, write down, and the last one says too many words. But with all these books, there's not a single one, and I can say this with confidence because I've thought about this and looked for it. There's not a single book there that tells you how to run a Zen Dojo. There's not a single book, or there's not a single anything, a page, chapter, whatever, that says what is the correct procedure for going to Dojo. Not there. How should we eat? We are jammed between this being there and foot. Not a word. You'll find a lot of books, you know, words and things like that. And they're all useful. They're motivators. None of them are answers, but they're motivators. You read something and say, well, okay, if that person did whatever it is they did, maybe there's some hope for me. So they're motivated. But in terms of, you won't find any cookbook about Zen. Not maybe more specific, about organization in the Sangha. So we won't find anything. And that's because there isn't any. What we're doing here is a living tradition. It's handed down by word of mouth, by instruction. The old Jisha, it's a new Jisha candidate, preps the person up, and that's the way you learn how to do Jisha. Or any other job, you observe, you're taught, living. Where should I go? How do I do it? Do it this way, do it this way. And it's shared, it's passed down. And so, since it is not written down and cannot be written down, since it's passed down, it is incumbent upon all of us to pay attention so that the tradition will not run into a pothole when it crosses our lifeline. The opening of this dharma, This Dharma.
What Dharma?
This Dharma. This Dharma. How will we prevail? Minutely subtle. Big as the universe. 13.7 billion light years. Counting. Subtle as that bird. It's alive. So we have to pay attention. Attention. Rich man traveled a long distance, went to see Ikkyu, and said, Master Ikkyu, write me some words of high significance, because Ikkyu is at the beginning of calligraphy as an art form in Japan. Master Ikkyu, write me some words of wisdom. You ask the character for attention. Well, could you expand on that a little bit? Twice running. Attention, attention. You need me a little more, please. Three times. Attention, attention, attention. Come on, I spent a lot of money, come a long way, buy a foot. What does that mean anyway? She says, attention simply means attention. There's that story that opening the Zen practice. Kepler Roshi's book was an introduction by Houston Smith. I read that for various reasons. Here we are again. Attention. And Roshi wisely changed the meal chant. Used to be. There was no support in his practice of mindfulness, which also his friend said, greed, anger, and delusion. What was it that? No, it's like having a trot for Latin. Then she changed it. What's most important is the practice of attention, which helps us cut through. Because this is not a practice of mindfulness, after all is said and done. We're not doing mindfulness here. We're cutting through. The pillow of man. The traditions are held in the stories that we call koans. We use them in a certain kind of way, but when you look at them, they, you know, these guys and gals, they were interacting and something happened that seemed to be significant, so they made a record of it. And we've got these, and they're these little stories. One bag, someone came in the Joshua's monastery and said, what's the cardinal principle of moving on? And she said, the oak tree and the devil. Silver spruce in the front yard. The palm tree down by the beach. And these stories both Cohen collections and just miscellaneous stories that are sort of held in the mind of the extended son. Tell us how people practice in various circumstances, various times, various places. And maybe one of the things we get out of Cohen practice is, well, if they did, so can I. So can we. There's always this discussion, sometimes it can get kind of heated these days, as to how much of the Japanese way of doing things do we need to hang on to, or hold on to, or hold preciously, hang on to, kind of sounds like this, cherish. And how much should we allow things to change? Because after all, this is not Japan. And while certain things are transferable, other things are maybe inspirational, but not so transferable. And we don't really know that yet. It's sort of like jumping out of an airplane with a parachute. They say, you know, get counting, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, full ripcord. So we've kind of jumped out of the Japanese airplane to practice Zen in America, and we're there. Is it 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, or 5,000, 6,000, 7,000? I mean, you know, we're supposed to pull the ripcord, or what is it, you know? Meanwhile, that's what Ada Roshi thought a lot about this. Shinji Roshi thinks a lot about this. I think that it's incumbent upon each and every one of us to think about this, so that there is a corporate working, the Sangha working. So that if we change something, or we add something, or we retain something, it's not just let's do it this way and end this meeting. I've got other engagements. It's something that comes out of here. It comes out of the Sangha's belly. Because it's a living tradition. It's not like Janesville down in Virginia, I guess it is. There are these places where you have these communities that sort of do it like it was once upon a time, where it's an enactment. This is not a play. Not an enactment. This is the real thing. This is a real sender. This is a real Sangha. And it's our responsibility, individually, corporately, to carry this tradition like we would a newborn baby. Because in this country, it is a newborn baby. Set a good example. You sit on these cushions. Whether you realize it or not, whether you've ever thought about it or not, you lead the men. Teachers. from that spot. The next session will be different, sitting on that spot. Don't know that you were sitting on that spot in that session, but they can feel. A 100 years from now, someone cushions will replace. That spot will still retain impression. You sitting, practicing this tradition. And so you want to leave a good example? Thank you. Not an example of perfection. An example of dedication. An example of accepting those vows. Making them part of your every breath. So that someday when somebody is sitting there, wherever, here, and they're struggling, they will feel a hidden resource. That lingers of the aroma of incense in a room after the incense is burned down. And you come in. So this session, whether you're here in this room or whether you are in our extended electronic room, makes no difference. So we have received this practice. We are the current messengers of this tradition. And in the years to come, let it be said this session, we receive passed on this wordless wonder
This has been a Zen Studies Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.